With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We really appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And as we like to do for those that are joining us live, and we're doing it at a little bit of a different time live this week. So I don't know if some of our folks maybe did adjust their calendar. But if you're with us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room. That's a great place if during the course of the show you have some observations you would like to share, or if there are some questions you would like for us to address our guest. We'll monitor that during the course of the show, and we'll be glad to bring in your good ideas as we go forward for the next hour. And for the next hour, as described in the preliminary work, preliminary post advertising the show, what we're going to do today is we're going to look back, which we've had a few shows over the course of the last 6 months or so on Afghanistan. And today with our guests, we've got an opportunity to go back both to look at a very personal story that those who were out and about at the time really remember, and it galvanized in the early months of the conflict, what people thought and what people began to understand about some of the larger aspects of the conflict, but also what we did and how we reacted and what Afghanistan was like in 2001, its commonality with what it was before and what it has become today. And our guest to discuss that is going to be the author Toby Harden. He's also a journalist and winner of the Orwell Prize for Books. He's a former foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and the Daily Telegraph, who reported from 33 countries, and somebody who should feel right at home here on Midrats. He also spent 10 years as an officer in the Royal Navy before becoming a journalist. Toby, welcome to Midrats.
Hi, great to be with you. Thank you.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on, and congratulations on the book. And it's, the timing is interesting, so to speak, when it came out in 2001.
Yeah.
And how everything wrapped up the way that it did in August. And I thought it just as an opportunity for you to set the table for the listener. Is the book I found interesting in this regard, in that it's a very personal story about individuals and people. And oftentimes when you're looking at big sweeping events, it's just the events and the big pieces on the map that move. But the further granular you get, you actually have individuals. And occasionally, like it was for one of the principal players in your story, if not the personal player of the story, you can get down to very granular individuals that tell a interesting story about nations and institutions and larger events. But it's also a great review for those, it's easy to forget that we had been involved with it for 20 years, which means a lot of people, they were not adults, are in their teens or actively looking when things kicked off. And it gives a snapshot of Afghanistan when we decided that we wanted to become another part of its story. So just as a backgrounder, what brought you to the story and made you realize that this is a book that you needed to produce?
Yeah, certainly. Well, it was a kind of a long and winding road, really. I mean, my background, as you can tell from the accent, as you mentioned, is British. But I was a foreign correspondent. After my time in the Navy, I was a news reporter in London briefly. And then my big break was Northern Ireland. And then I was, because Northern Ireland became political, I got the reputation for being able to cover politics, even though I've never been a lover of politics. So I got sent to Washington in 99 and was just kind of wondering a little bit about, how this sort of fitted my sort of, talents and sort of aspirations, because it seemed like a lot of guys in suits and, the Oval Office and Capitol Hill, et cetera. But then, of course, 9/11, I'd been in the U.S. for 2 years on 9/11, and, I was walking into the office in Washington, D.C., and there's reports of a plane that, flown into the World Trade Center. And, that cliche that's also true, my life changed as did so many others. And so I wanted to get to Afghanistan. I was pretty frustrated that I couldn't. But obviously, they wanted the guy in Washington to cover the Washington politics. And I was pretty well established covering the Bush administration at that point. But I vividly remember Mike Spann being killed in the news and how rare it was for a CIA officer to be his affiliation to be made public. And Mike's funeral at Arlington Cemetery on in early, I think it's December 7th, 2001, and Shannon Spann, also a CIA officer whose affiliation was also made public, delivering this sort of beautiful eulogy. And I remember John Walker Lind, the so-called American Taliban, this American from California that was one of the prisoners. In fact, he was Al-Qaeda. But then everything moved on. It was anthrax and Iraq and all the rest of it. It really just stuck with me what an amazing, person Mike Spann sounded like and just what was he doing there? What was the story of the team? And then a couple of years later, probably about 3 years later, I was in Iraq, strangely enough, and somebody said, "Did you ever see the footage of that CIA officer who was with Mike Spann, running through the fort in Mazar-i-Sharif?" And I hadn't, and I looked at it, and that was David Tyson, who was actually a CIA case officer, not a paramilitary. Mike was a paramilitary. And, there's this footage of him with clutching an AK and a pistol, running through the fort and sort of bursting into this building on the north end of the fort and sort of bumping into a German film crew. And I remember looking at David's eyes, a classic sort of 1,000-yard stare, and he just seen Mike killed. He'd just killed dozens of Al-Qaeda getting out, and he was not an elite warrior type by any means. I mean, he had served in the army a couple of short stints, but his background was sort of linguist and academic in Central Asian studies. And I just remember looking at David and thinking, like, what has that guy been through? He's just been through this sort of carnage, this near-death experience. He doesn't know whether he's going to survive the next few hours. He doesn't know how he's going to get out. And I was just fascinated by him. And so a few years later, it was about 2013, I was back in the States and kind of, covering U.S. politics. I remember covering Chris Christie's run for re-election in New Jersey and not feeling kind of delighted about, the story or the person actually either. And so I decided to try and track David down, and I found an acknowledgement to him in an academic book, and I emailed a professor at Indiana University, and then so I was in New Jersey, and the phone rang, and it was David Tyson. So we met up, and he was still serving in the CIA, and I couldn't he couldn't really talk to me in any great depth, he was probably sort of sounding me out and sort of reporting back, but I could tell from the way he spoke that he, on some level, really wanted to tell this story, and that he was telling it internally. And so for various reasons, not least that David was still serving, it kind of got shelved at that point. But then 2019, I thought, well, you know, 20th anniversary of 9/11 is approaching, and it looks like the end of our involvement in Afghanistan is approaching. Although at that point, I didn't know it was going to end sort of exactly on the anniversary or just before, in fact, in the end. But the deadline, Biden's first deadline was the 20th anniversary for, you know, the deadline for pulling out troops. And so I thought, this is the time, you know. And I actually got the deal without having anything guaranteed. I mean, I'd spoken to some Green Berets in 2013, and I was pretty confident David would speak, but not certain. But there were no guarantees. And then I had the contract signed, you know, and a month later, David emailed me and said, hey, sorry, I haven't been in touch. I've just retired. I'm ready to talk. And so it went from there, and I just pieced it together. And then it was sort of like parallel tracks. There was the book research and writing. And at the same time, obviously the anniversary was approaching, but also the end of our involvement. And then we went to the 2020 campaign. Both candidates were pretty much committed to pulling out all American troops. And so it just happened to come at this point, you know, which, you know, also my pitch had been, this is history now. You know, it's not classified. We're not going to compromise any sources and methods here. And also most people had retired but were still young enough to kind of, be mostly alive and mostly be able to recall the event. So, yeah, that's how it came about.
Well, a couple of questions. One is, did you have to get this vetted by the CIA at all, or was it was that necessary? And the second question, well, go ahead and answer that one first. Did the CIA get a look at this before published it?
No, they didn't. And I've been through an extremely bruising experience with a book I wrote before called Dead Men Riven with the British Ministry of Defense in 2011. They ended up with the book being pulsed, first print run being pulsed. And, you know, there's no First Amendment there, and it's a very different, you know, the deal was to get the access and get the embed. I had to submit the manuscript, and they would vet it for, you know, accuracy and security, which were two very elastic terms. And that turned into an absolute nightmare. So I was concerned about that. But no, I had no relationship with the CIA. I had no in with them. And I started off just, you know, I talked to David. I talked to J.R. Seeger, the chief, who's long retired. I talked to Justin Sapp, who was a Green Beret, detailed to the team, who was still serving, but, you know, just found him on LinkedIn. And they were all sort of talking. And then at a certain point, you know, one guy, Andy, on the team, a paramilitary, was still serving and is still serving, pretty senior now, but he couldn't speak to me without agency permission. So I sort of, you know, somewhat tentatively and with, you know, a lot of nervousness, contacted the agency public affairs branch and said, hey, this is what I'm doing. And they were like, yeah, we know. Word traveled. But they were pretty quickly helpful. Now, they didn't open the vaults. They didn't give me all their cables or anything like that. All my freedom of information requests were refused. I mean, that's a different department. But they did give the okay for serving officers to talk to me and retirees who were still contracting and wanted the okay from the agency. So, yeah, that's how I did it. But at no point did they ask, and at no point would I have ever given them the manuscript. And so that was, you know, I was pleased about that.
Well, when you one of the great things, when I was reading the book, I'm going, well, this guy, the people with the local knowledge, or at least the ability to speak the language of the area, were essential to whatever success we had early on in the Afghan adventure. And you focused on David Tyson as a key figure. What about the background of the other people that already served in that area? And their knowledge of the local political, if you want to call it political, local knowledge of the tribes and the various alliances that as they came and went. How important was that?
Yeah. Well, it was very important. But, you know, this experience was thin on the ground, even at the CIA. So clearly the context for all this and the background, which I wanted to include with a light sort of touch, because it's not a sort of dry as dust history book, as you say, it's very much a people-driven narrative that also speaks to the broader context. But I really do believe the best stories are about people, and they help to sort of draw you in and relate to those events. But it's interesting. So the makeup of the team. So we're talking about CIA Team Alpha, who was the first CIA team behind an enemy line. So there was a previous team, Jawbreaker, that went into the Panjshir Valley, but they were with the Northern Alliance in sort of safe territory. And it turned out the Tajiks from the Northern Alliance, Ahmed Shah Massoud had just been assassinated by Al-Qaeda 2 days before 9/11. And the Tajiks didn't really move, didn't want to fight. They wanted money. They wanted lots of U.S. bombing, et cetera, et cetera. But Team Alpha worked with Abdul Rashid Dostum, an ethnic Uzbek and the sort of warlord from Central Casting who'd fought with the Soviets against the Mujahideen, notoriously brutal and notorious for switching sides. So if you look at Team Alpha, so there are eight of them. And there were two with deep linguistic and cultural experience. And the first one was J.R. Seeger, the chief. So he was a former 82nd Airborne captain. He also had degrees in ancient history and anthropology. He was a Dari linguist, and he'd worked with the Mujahideen against Dostum out of CIA's Islamabad station in the 1980s. And the other person with the linguistic and local expertise was David Tyson, who had, he was 40 years old at the time. JR was 47. So these are people who'd been around a bit. And David had joined the CIA just 3 or 4 years before, and he was the only Uzbek speaker in the CIA, and also spoke Dari and lots of other languages. And he'd lived in Central Asia for several years, at one point he was so close to going native he didn't own a pair of shoes. And the rest of the team was sort of more conventional, more what you would expect. Alex Hernandez was the deputy chief. He was former 10th Group Special Forces Sergeant Major, who'd full career in Special Forces, and went on to have a 20-year paramilitary career in the CIA. There was Mark Rausenberger, who was a medic, former Army. Justin Sapp, who was a serving Green Beret, who was detailed to the team. Andy, I mentioned, was the former Special Forces reservist. Who was also relatively recently joined, and Mike Spann, who was a former Marine and Anglico, Air Naval Gunfire Liaison Company officer, who was also fairly new to the CIA. So it was an eclectic team of some, elite warriors, but also linguists and sort of Afghan hands, if you like. And, if we could have replicated that, across Afghanistan, for the next couple of years, things may have been different. But certainly with Team Alpha, with using really the principles of the, OSS, alongside Green Berets, and ODA came in shortly afterwards, ODA 595, the famous horse soldiers. And, the principles were that it was an Afghan fight, very small numbers of Americans. I mean, in this period, we had hundreds of Americans, not, 100,000. And they were advisors to the indigenous resistance who were fighting the foreign invaders of the Taliban, and more specifically, of the Arabs from Al-Qaeda. Most of the fights, there was the awesome might of U.S. air power above, Navy jets and U.S. Marine Corps and Air Force, and that certainly tilted the military equation. But the bulk of the fighting on the ground was done by the Afghans on horseback, with the Americans to one side. And the Americans, they had soft lambs to, call in laser-guided missiles, but they went in, Team Alpha went in with Kalashnikovs and Glock pistols. No body armor, no helmets, no uniforms, no cool kit. And so it was kind of old school. It was like the Jedburgh teams, in World War II of SOE. and OSS and all those principles. And, you know, it was a provisional victory. It's easy to remove a regime, as we know, and much less easy to sort of fill a vacuum afterwards. But we essentially won much more quickly than anybody would think. And then, of course, spent, you know, I guess the next few decades slowly losing.
It's interesting. That's one thing that I enjoyed about the book is regular listeners know, you know, we've talked on previous shows about, you know, the staff weenie view back in the fall of 2001 and the winter of 2002 is we're in for some type of small little operation, somewhere between punitive expedition and just a very specific mission, very much in line with, you know, and again, if you could flesh out a little more, I thought one of the more interesting characters early on was Kofor Black. And it almost seemed like the problem was a different definition of this. When you are asked, can you do this? Kofor Black and his CIA said, okay, if you define this as throwing over the Taliban and using the indigenous people to do that, yeah, we can do this. But I guess it wasn't very, very well communicated. Or do you think it had yet to fully evolve that Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, their definition and the administration's definition of what this would be, which I guess you could pull a thread and somewhere between D.C. and Brussels and the Bonn Accords afterwards redefined what this is. Do you see that disconnect between defining this early on that kind of led to what you said two decades later, a slowly losing?
Yeah, so that's a good way of putting it. The this changed. I think that this at the beginning, so the CIA, again, this was part, an important part of the context, which, you know, not many people sort of remember at this point. So you'd had the Soviet period from the invasion, the decade of the 80s, essentially, when the Soviets had occupied, they left in 89, and the CIA had been deeply involved in Afghanistan, you know, giving Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen and helping defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan, and, you know, arguably, a lot of CIA people would claim that was, you know, one of the nails in the coffin of the Soviet Union. But then the United States left, and there was a small number of Afghan hands who, you know, stayed in contact. And then in the 1990s, you had the rise of Al-Qaeda, and eventually, by I think 96, you had bin Laden being given sanctuary, leaving Sudan and being given sanctuary, Afghanistan, along with Al-Qaeda by the Taliban regime. So then you had the Alec Station, the bin Laden unit within the CIA, which was part of the counterterrorism center, which was led by Kofor Black, sort of sounding the alarm. And you had the USS Cole October 2000. You had the embassy bombings in East Africa in 1998. So, you know, Al-Qaeda killing Americans, attacking, major American targets. More and more intelligence that Al-Qaeda is coming to America. And so the alarm was being sounded, and it was, you know, this kind of blinking red was the phrase used by George Tenet, then the CIA director, you know, by 2001. But from 1999, there were CIA officers flying into Afghanistan. And in fact, David Tyson was on one of the early missions in 1999. They'd fly in from, you know, Tajikistan into the Panjshir Valley and talk to Ahmed Shah Massoud about, you know, gathering intelligence and helping him financially. And there were lots of sort of caveats, and, you know, the CIA wanted to go kill bin Laden. Clinton administration and the Bush administration, you know, weren't really into that because, you know, assassinations and all that kind of stuff. Of course, all that changed on 9/11. But on 9/11, to the CIA, it would be too much to say that they had a plan, but they had a kind of a concept of you know, working with the indigenous resistance against Taliban, the Taliban, and, you know, by extension, Al-Qaeda. Pentagon didn't have a plan. I mean, it was astonishing, really. But, you know, Tommy Franks basically came up with nothing. So, you know, it'll take 2 or 3 months to come up with, you know, something, you know, with hundreds of thousands of troops sort of rolling in. And Bush, you know, and the nation in a way, I think, they weren't into that. We wanted vengeance. We wanted to get these people immediately. We wanted to stop the next attack. And so Kofa Black, as you say, you know, he's a very sort of theatrical character, you know, legendary case officer in Africa, and, you know, tracked down Abu Nidal, and you know, he was targeted himself by Al-Qaeda at one point. And it was kind of Kofa Black's moment and the CIA's moment, because they had the concept of the plan, and the Pentagon was kind of, you know, frozen in place. Rumsfeld was very upset. And Kofa Black also, you know, he's a case officer, so he knows how to build a rapport. He know how, you know, he knows his sort of target, and his target was really to persuade Bush. And so he gave this, you know, kind of very bloodthirsty presentation, about, you know, talking a lot about, you know, killing these guys, and said, you know, when we're over, there's going to be flies walking across their eyeballs. And, you know, Bush loved this, and, you know, and that was kind of the mood of the nation at the time as well. But this, you know, going back to this that you mentioned, was basically remove Al-Qaeda, gather intelligence about who carried out 9/11, and prevent the next attack. It wasn't build, you know, centralized, you know, shining beacon of democracy in Afghanistan, you know, based in Kabul, and, you know, excluding the so-called warlords from power and pumping money and, you know, big army and big military and huge bases and supply lines and all the stuff it became. I mean, ironically, and I think sort of tragically, I think it was the success, you know, relative and provisional. But the success and the speed in which we toppled, you know, Team Alpha and the Green Berets and all those guys toppled the Taliban regime in 2001, that led the Bush administration to sort of think, well, this is easy. Regime change is pretty easy. We'll go do another one in Iraq, and, you know, we'll try and change Afghanistan into, you know, a better country that we can have bases in, you know, long term, and will be kind of, you know, a beacon of light in the region and in the world. And you mentioned the Bonn conference. I mean, you know, I'm not trying to sit here in 2022 and pretend any of this would have been easy, or if only we'd done this, then it all would have worked out fine. But, you know, the Taliban, the mood was with us or against us. You know, they're terrorists or they're allies. And the Taliban would, you know, they were not invited to Bonn, and even though Karzai, who was the chosen leader by the West and very sort of palatable to, you know, American and Western kind of sensibilities, he wanted more portion of the Taliban incorporated into the new regime, which would have been Afghan tradition, and you know, they would have been obviously you know, negotiating the Taliban from a position of great weakness. But Rumsfeld was, and the Bush administration was, no way, absolutely not. You know, these people are, you know, if not dead to us, and we're going to have nothing to do with them. And and so, you know, and there were people at the time, I mean, there was a CIA officer called Arturo Munoz, you know, who was talked to me, you know, he's still angry about it 20 years later, that we had the opportunity to negotiate it with the sort of defeated rump of the Taliban. And it, you know, the whole thing could have changed. We would not have been on this track of, you know, banishing the Taliban and then eventually regenerating. And yeah, and obviously at the end, the negotiation was essentially, you know, under the Trump administration, an American surrender to the Taliban. So yes, this very much changed from a limited operation in 2001 to some, you know, the classic sort of mission creep of a much broader and evolving as the years went on.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack in this stuff, because a lot of the book discusses the frequently changing alliances and or pretend alliances and the relationships between the various ethnic and religious the Sunnis and the Shias and the all that, plus the context of the relationship with Pakistan and the other surrounding countries. I mean, a lot of it's the great game with slightly different players, but it's the same ease with which some of these folks just change sides. The trick that was played by the Taliban and Al Qaeda in getting the prisoners taken that eventually ended up with Mike Spann's death. But talk about that a little bit, about the environment that we got ourselves into, and we seemed a little fuzzy on that as we got in. I think we did a pretty good job, as you said, early on with early success, but I'm not sure we really understood the total picture of what we were playing with.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, there was early success, but it was very complicated, and it's sort of almost eerie. I mean, I found in the research and talking to people how there were sort of indications of problems to come. So even in success, in this relatively limited operation, and the Trojan. So if you look at shifting alliances, this kind of murkiness of relationships between Afghan tribes and ethnic groups, the very fuzzy notion of surrender, operational problems. Like there was a big friendly fire incident on November 26th during the Battle of Kalajangi when a 20,000-pound JDAM was dropped by the U.S. Marine Corps F-18 on the friendly position. And in success, a lot of these complications and these problems, which could have been indications of this is really murky and complicated, even in a limited operation, do we really want to get into that? They were sort of, David Tyson was fascinating on this because he's a guy who, speaks near fluent Uzbek, had, been in and out of Afghanistan and really bonded with the Afghans and understands them on a level, I think, that very few Americans do. And he said that he had a realization about a month into this, and he would talk about the Afghan onion, peeling the Afghan onion, like the different layers of sort of intrigue and nuance where you think something's straightforward, but actually there are several layers of stuff underneath it that shows it's not straightforward. And he said he came to the conclusion, after about a month, that he could spend several lifetimes in Afghanistan, speaking the language and sort of talking to the people and working with them, and he would never fully understand it. And he's still like that to this day. I mean, he's still working with Afghans now, getting Afghan allies out of the country. And so, November 25th, 2001, as you mentioned, the uprising, the Al Qaeda uprising at the fort, which was masterminded by Mullah Fazl, who was sort of known as the Butcher of the North at the time, ethnic cleansing of Hazaras, and he was the deputy defense minister, and is now the deputy defense minister in the new Taliban regime. I mean, his plot was in some ways genius, to have a fake surrender, to sort of use the Afghan tradition of not properly searching, and sort of kind of honor in surrender, to have these guys, who none of whom were Afghan, basically sort of, go behind the Northern Alliance lines into the fort and stage an uprising, which was part of a plan to retake Mazar-i-Sharif, which if it'd been coordinated a little bit better and maybe they'd had slightly, better luck, it may well have come off. And so, yes, I mean, there were a lot of indications, and I think people like J.R. Seeger and David Tyson on Team Alpha and other CIA officers, at the time they were like, whoa, this is, we got rid of the Taliban and that's great, but this, maybe time now is to sort of hand this over to the Afghans and it's going to be messy And, you know, we can work with them and alongside them, you know, on the same sort of principles. But if we get too enmeshed in this, you know, it's going to be, you know, look at what happened to the British and look at what happened to the Soviets.
You know, it's funny. Every large institution is made up of the small individuals that are in it. And sometimes an institution can be molded by the individuals, and more often than not, the institutions mold the individuals themselves. But I think it's good to remember that, you know, before the events of 9/11, if you were to set out a global map and said, okay, tell me what your first, second, and third tier areas of interest are, Central Asia specialist would probably be the fourth tier. It was just a backwater of a backwater. And I think David Tyson is such an interesting character in a couple of ways. Individual, I mean, he's an actual person, not a character,
is
we all known, especially those of us who have been around academia, there are certain people in academia or in your life who have very unique and particular interests not that nobody else cares about, but many people don't discover. And he seems to have been one of those characters that had a take for language, was really in love with a certain part of the world that nobody else seemed to care too much about. And when you look at the CIA that has an institutional reputation, and most people either know it from reading fiction or some of the unfortunate characters that they see from the Washington, D.C. establishment that have a CIA tag on their lapel. But when you look at David Tyson, you know, Michael Spahn, like a lot of the guys on the paramilitary wing, are kind of out of central casting. But his wife, Shannon, as well, when you look at Shannon and David's background, it reminds you that the CIA still has a history of finding some unique people that in the end, they are one person deep if you have a crisis in a part of the world. But talk a little bit about Shannon Bond and David Tyson's background and how they kind of accidentally found their way being talked into working for the CIA of all places.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. And also, you know, Mike is interesting because I feel that Mike was, in a way, the sort of personification of America after 9/11. He's a conservative guy from Alabama. He was, you know, black and white, with us or against us. He was the first thing to get to Al-Qaeda. But, you know, he died age 32. And is therefore kind of frozen in time in this sort of monochromatic way. But, you know, I do believe, I mean, this guy called Brian, actually, who's also an Marine Corps officer who served with Mike and joined the CIA at the same time as Shannon and Mike. They were on the same course at the farm starting in 1999. And Brian, I think, is just about to retire, but reached very senior rank, held station-chief positions across the world, and became a case officer. And so Mike may well have developed, and I think, you know, the likelihood is he probably would have developed into, you know, a very rounded and kind of broad-based CIA officer. Scott Spellmeyer was apparently, you know, he was the sort of number three on the team, and he was a former Ranger. He'd been wounded in the Black Hawk Down kind of battle of Mogadishu in 93, you know. He broadened out, became station chief in Kabul, senior CIA officer on the National Security Council. So the paramilitaries with talent, you know, did tend to sort of broaden, you know, over the past 20 years. But Shannon and David, yeah, I mean, Shannon was from Orange County, California, Christian background, but, you know, very committed Christian and still is. To this day, she'd been through, she married her high school sweetheart, it hadn't worked out, she'd become a lawyer, and she saw an advert, I think, in The Economist, which was just targeted at, you know, people who were sort of different, and she was, you know, she was almost the opposite of Mike's fan, you know, I mean. And in fact, the fact that he marriage, I think, showed his sort of expanding horizons. And so she had no military background herself or in the family, but she, you know, very intelligent, you know, meticulous, sort of determined person. And she had there was a sort of streak of patriotism in the family, you know, I think through the father working on the space program and stuff, but certainly not what you know, she told her friend she was joining the State Department, and they thought that was unusual, but that kind of made some sense. But actually she was joining the CIA. And I mean, David, you know, very modest background, Pennsylvania, kind of almost sort of, you know, very plain, simple kind of Mennonite kind of background. I mean, his brother, in fact, this, you know, I didn't get into this depth of his family in the book, but you know, it was interesting to me, his one brother, who's a plumber, and has never left Pennsylvania, and actually lives in the same house that David grew up in, where his mother's still alive, their mother's still alive, and she's 94 now, and she, you know, she grew up attending a one-room schoolhouse, and they're still in Pennsylvania. But David, for whatever reason, you know, when he was 17, he wrote off the French Foreign Legion, said, "I want to join." And he couldn't because he didn't have money for the ticket to France. But he joined the army as an artilleryman, you know, went to Germany, played a lot of basketball, but didn't do much kind of hardcore stuff. And then he studied Russian. He took a course in Russian at college, and he just sort of found his kind of path in life. He realized that he was a gifted linguist. He sort of calculated or was advised by a mentor that, you know, there was too many Russian speakers around. You know, if you want to carve out a career in this stuff, you clearly love it, then go for something obscure. And that led him to Central Asia and, you know, learning Uzbek and Turkmen and just falling in love with that culture. But at the same time, you know, his father had been in the Navy in World War II, and I think was on board the USS Intrepid when it was, you know, hit by, you know, kamikaze Japanese suicide bombers, there's sort of a strong patriotism there, and sort of notion of service. And, you know, David visited the Soviet Union as a student, and you know, he believed in America, the United States, the American way. And, you know, because he was going to these obscure places, you know, he the CIA really found that out, and used to sort of debrief him, and, you know, they declared themselves, and David was happy to help and sort of ask him, you know, who he knew, what he'd seen, and, you know, because he'd been to places where, you know, the CIA didn't have people on the ground. And that, you know, that person who would debrief him, who was a woman who called herself Sandy, I think it wasn't her real name, you know, she suggested he should apply to the agency. And, you know, David, you know, I've got to know David very well, considering him a good friend, and his wife, Roseanne, they were standing in a, you know, parking lot in Bloomington, Indiana, you know, in the snow. And David had this, they had two young kids. David had this offer from the CIA, and they were like, well, what, you know, what are we going to do? This is a fork in the road. We, you know, stay in academia and eke out this kind of precarious life, or do we go for this sort of new adventure? And one of the deciding factors was healthcare, you know, so it was good government healthcare. And so they went for it. And another interesting thing about David is I think he's always sort of a member of the tribe. And so, you know, he worked with homeless people in the sort of subterranean New York when he was a student at Columbia briefly. and got so into their stories and their relationships and their sort of culture, and almost, you know, Wazan was a bit worried that he was sort of, you know, becoming one of them. And I think in academia, he threw himself into it and made some great sort of friendships, and in this, and the CIA was his new tribe. And so he threw himself into it, and he's as you intimated, he's a person who, you know, plows his own furrow. I mean, he hates bureaucracy, he hates paperwork. I mean, he knows how to get things done, so he will work inside a system, and not, you know, just all the time like some people do, and those are the careers that tend to end in disaster. But, you know, David is sort of notorious for doing what David sort of wants to do, and getting people to do what he would like them to do. And so, yeah, a really interesting person, you know, with, you know, difficult to manage, but with sort of immense talent. And, you know, I do think we need people like that in the CIA, in the armed forces, because otherwise you have groupthink. You become, you know, it's all about, you know, zero defects mentality and risk aversion. And I think this early period after 9/11 showed that, you know, that some of the mavericks, the people who, you know, came at things from a different direction and kind of thought outside the box, to use that sort of cliche, were the type of people that we needed.
Mark, are you there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Early on in the book, you were discussing it's that on-off switch again. The friction between the U.S. military and the CIA teams, and sometimes the military was so risk adverse that it was causing issues for the CIA teams trying to get on with their mission. Could you kind of discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, so like a lot of these things, on the ground, they work together almost seamlessly. So ODA 595, the four soldiers, the movie 12 Strong, 12 Green Berets who sort of came in after Team Alpha and sort of worked alongside them. And the other ODA that was with Atta. So Atta Mohammed Noor was the Tajik sort of warlord who was the ally slash rival of Dostum, and they eventually worked together to take Mazar-e Sharif. So a second ODA came in with them, and a smaller CIA team, a Team Bravo, which was three members, came in to work with 534 and that all worked extremely well. But the higher up the chain you got, the more difficult it became. And so, you know, you had Rumsfeld and Tenet, who, you know, I think, you know, Tenet worked Rumsfeld pretty well and was, you know, very good at sort of interpersonal relationships. But you know, Rumsfeld was very upset that the Pentagon was not leading the war, and, you know, made damn sure that, you know, the Pentagon was going to be in charge in Iraq, which is, you know, a completely different story. But, you know, you had big debates in the army hierarchy about uniforms, whether to wear uniforms or not. You had a big debate about combat search and rescue. So there was this kind of doctrinally, you know, you couldn't have Green Beret teams going in unless you had CSAR in place so that, you know, if they got in trouble, they could be rescued, and, you know, you couldn't have pilots flying without a CSAR sort of component. And CIA was just like, we're going anyway. And Hank Crumpton, who was the sort of the deputy to Kofa Black, who ran the war sort of day to day, he was like, he said to Tommy Franks, listen, we'd love to have you with us, but we're going anyway. And so that led to the CIA going in before the Green Berets. You also had, you know, a lot of tension over the ODAs, you know, led by captains, army captains, being the link with, the military link with warlords, like Abdul-Rashid Dostum, who was, I guess, you know, in those days always referred to as General Dostum and kind of a four-star, you know. And so when the U.S. started winning, Rumsfeld was like, you know, don't we need some, you know, two stars or brigadier generals in there? You know, should we really be have the United States being represented by a captain? And so you actually had battalion elements, you know, lieutenant colonels flown in above the ODAs, which created a lot of friction because the relationship between actually Mark Nooch was the captain commanding 595, already built a very sort of strong rapport with Dostum, and all of a sudden he had a lieutenant colonel come in, elbow him to one side, and you know, he's the new sort of liaison guy with Dostum. And actually, two or three weeks after that, there was a two-star came in, Rear Admiral Calland, Burke Calland, who was SOC sent, you know, Special Operations Commander for Central Command. He took over from the Lieutenant Colonel. And the CIA was sort of, you know, mystified by this, really, because they had a very flat structure. You know, you had J.R. Seeger, who I guess was a GS-15, so kind of a colonel equivalent. You know, David Tyson was a very junior officer, but, you know, carried a fair amount of weight because of his linguistic expertise and his recent experience in Afghanistan. And it was quite a sort of, you know, JR was the chief, and they respected that, but it was quite sort of democratic in a way, and it wasn't run, you know, along, you know, traditional military lines. You know, they would talk to Hank Crumpton every day, but they would make the decisions. Hank Crumpton would almost always, you know, go with what J.R. Seeger or Alex Hernandez or David Tyson wanted to do, whereas the military had to go through Task Force Dagger, which was commanded by John Mulholland, who was a colonel, who really should have been a one or a two-star there, and that's Mulholland for himself, but Mulholland had the Pentagon breathing down his neck, and sometimes even Rumsfeld himself, you know, making calls to people, you know, who would get very upset when helicopters couldn't fly, you know, on the, you know, on a fairly reasonable basis that, you know, everybody might die if they did because the weather was so bad and the altitude they had to go. So yes, it was very different between the military and the CIA, and at the top there was quite a lot of friction.
You know, there are some points in a story that you can look at a pivot point, and as you're talking about that, and you know, Colonel Mulholland seems like his story, you could almost make a book out of it as well. But you mentioned the point when Rear Admiral, his boss, Rear Admiral Burke Collins, when he finally showed up in Mazar-e Sharif, he got off with his master chief, who was carrying a starched uniform in its plastic dry cleaning bag. Yeah, that's one of those dividing lines when things definitely change. I want it because this individual is still with us, and this is why, you know, this part of the story everybody's trying to partner with him, is he's a larger than life character, and I just want to see how you felt about trying to tell his story, because depending upon what angle or time you're looking at, you know, general or marshal or pasha, Abdul Rashid Dostum, it's either a comedy, a horror movie, or a farce in trying to write this character. As a journalist who, you know, really deals not without, you know, people and event interchange, how did you go into writing this book with what, you know, anybody that's been involved in business has an image one way or another of Dostum? And how did you come out of it, having to see his interplay with the other individuals in the story?
Yeah, well, he's a fascinating character. You know, so I went to, you know, I spent more than a month in Afghanistan towards sort of November, December 2020, and interviewed Dostum in his kind of headquarters in Shebagan, which at that point was sort of surrounded by the Taliban. It took me 10 days to get in and nearly 2 weeks to get out because, you know, he had to, he couldn't use the roads, even though it would have been a 45-minute or so drive, you know, the Taliban checkpoints, and so he needed to get a helicopter out and all that. I mean, Dossam is a fascinating guy. I mean, I would not have put, you know, any money on him surviving the last 20 years, but he's currently in exile in Ankara, and, you know, I think he's done. I think he's out of money. He's, you know, out of ideas. He's 69 years old now. His health is not great. I mean, he's certainly been fond of the bottle over the years, and this is a kind of scene in First Casualty that I kind of enjoyed writing, which was on the night of November 25th when Dostum gets drunk. You know, he hits the vodka. His reputation precedes him. Before 9/11, the U.S. government really didn't want very much to do with him, and in fact, the U.S. government was not in contact with him. I mean, Tashkent Station was sort of, you know, in Uzbekistan was leading on Dostum because, you know, he's an ethnic Uzbek, and the Uzbek Security Service had a relationship with him. But Tashkent Station hadn't got the green light to talk to Dostum, and I think it would have happened within sort of weeks. But the first, you know, David Tyson spoke to Dostum after 9/11. You know, and he hadn't been able to do it before. And, you know, all these tales, which I think are sort of, you know, many of them sort of apocryphal, of, you know, him, you know, tying, you know, enemies to the tank treads and crushing them and this kind of stuff. I think the problem is Dostum, who certainly had blood on his hands, as did all of these guys. I mean, no sort of Mother Teresa's, you know, available in Afghanistan in 2001. But he sort of gloried in this reputation because, you know, it sort of worked for him, you know, internally, because he was regarded with sort of, you know, love, but also sort of fear and clearly from his enemies. And he was a wily character, but, you know, this didn't play well with, you know, Western governments. It didn't play well with the State Department. And there was this incident, which I asked Dostum about, you know, notorious incident, you know, the desert, you know, the Dasht-e Layli, the desert of, desert of lilies or the desert of death, lilies, I think. But there were, you know, this allegation that he shot hundreds, and the numbers kept on going up, thousands of Taliban prisoners in containers or left them to bake to death. And there were lots of incidents over the years of prisoners being put in shipping containers in Afghanistan. It was a common sort of method of transport and keeping them, and lots of sort of atrocities associated with containers. But this particular one in late November 2001, which really stuck to him, and was the reason why he was basically persona non grata in the eyes of the State Department. He's never been to the United States in the last 20 years. I asked him about it, and I expected him to completely deny the whole thing. But he said, well, you know, there was a young commander who'd lost two brothers to the Taliban, and he was emotional, and yeah, he did shoot a few of the prisoners. And so, but I had nothing to do with it. I didn't know about it. And, I felt it was somewhat honest. You know, clearly something had happened. And the allegations of the scale of this and U.S. involvement and CIA being involved and Green Berets being involved, clearly not the case. But you know, that story had sort of been his undoing. And, I mean, he was really marginalized after 2001. I mean, in 2001, he was the guy. You know, the Team Alpha members still revere him, and so do the Green Berets, because, you know, while the Tajiks were just kind of, you know, frozen in place in the Panjshir Valley, Dostum wanted to fight, and he had the means to fight, and he was a ferocious fighter, and that's what was needed. But as a sort of, you know, I guess as a, you know, a figure in the new Afghanistan, he wasn't really welcome. Even though, you know, he did have, huge sway in the north. So he was, it was fascinating to meet him. It was fascinating to, learn about sort of his humor, his sort of wiliness, his, you know, he was an uneducated man, you know, hadn't, you know, left school at, you know, the age of 12 or something. But a really, really interesting character. And there's a good biography, actually, of him, you know, very sort of positive, kind of a positive take on Gosnell, but Brian Glynn Williams, the last warlord. But I was really pleased that I was able to you know, get to interview him.
Well, I was interested in the title of the book because I don't know if you picked it, but you know, the first casualty in war has been known to be the truth, or the, you know,
yeah,
first contact with the enemy. Or in this case, you decided to Mike Spann, but interesting title. Did you get to choose it? And did you have all of those things in mind when you chose it?
Yes, I did. I did. So the original title was The Fort, because it was the original idea for the book was to be much, and Kalajangi, I mean, there's several chapters on Kalajangi, but I was going to focus much more sort of centrally on the sort of 6-day battle. And then I found out more and more about the overall CIA mission. And so the publisher, you know, we started batting around some other ideas. And Vanessa Mobley, who's my editor at Little Brown, who's now actually senior opinion editor at the New York Times, she's just left publishing, sadly. She came up with this idea, and I liked it because it, yes, it gets you straight into first casualty, you know, Mike Spann on one level. But as you say, the truth, the first casualty, you know, of any operation is the plan, you know, when reality sets in. So I felt it had a couple of layers to it, so that's what we went with.
Well, Toby, it's been an absolute great hour, and I really appreciate the time to talk to you and kind of point our listeners in the direction if they haven't looked at the beginning of the conflict in Afghanistan. I think that seeing the background and seeing the players, it not only gives people a different perspective on that, but it also, in a lot of ways, you did a great job of humanizing the people who are in the CIA that rightfully so are often in the background, and gives a little bit of the human detail to that. Again, Toby's book is First Casualty, The Untold Story of the CIA Mission to Avenge 9/11. The link is over on the show page. And Toby, for the listeners, what are you working on next? And where would be a good place for them to keep an eye on you?
So what's next, you know, to be decided. But, you know, I've you know, just written a proposal for another book. And you know, it's you know, currently with publishers now. And so we'll see what happens with that. But you know, I'd certainly, you know, want to get – I first book, Bandit Country, about the IRA in Northern Ireland, and then it was 10 years before Dead Men Risen about British and Helm, and then another 10 years before First Casualty. I need to up my hit rate, you know, so I'm not going to wait another 10 years. The way to – otherwise we'll kind of run out of life here, you know, at the age of 56. But, you know, tobyharnden.com is my website. You know, I'm trying to be pretty available. I post a lot of content on Instagram, actually a lot of photos. I realized I had 16,000 photos from this period. So I'm Toby Harnden 1, the number 1 on Instagram, and at Toby Harnden on the book's available on Amazon and all the places where books are sold. So yes, I'm trying to be fairly kind of accessible these days.
Well, that's great. I will definitely put a point there to your Instagram page on the show page. I'll update that. Thanks again, and look forward to the opportunity to talk to you again at some point down the road, hopefully before 2030.
Yeah, exactly. thanks so much. I really enjoyed it and appreciate being on the show.
No, thank you for talking to us. It's been great. Very informative.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.